Fannie Mae and Chris Dodd's sweetheart mortgage deals. We support candidates who tell us they want transparency and accountability, yet we still can't find out who is behind pork projects or who slipped last-minute amendments into legislation. Are there any additional broken promises needed for us to finally realize that these parties all come from the same contaminated source? Both have been infected with progressivism, the belief that your individual rights are subservient to government power, and that no personal liberty is above sacrificing for the greater good, a term that is conveniently defined by government politicians and bureaucrats. Our collective experience since the founding has taught us that all governments of every stripe are fascist in nature. They will gobble up as much money, resources, and people as possible unless adequately checked. Governments are never static. They always grow. Communism, fascism, socialism, imperialism, statism, they're all different ends accomplished through the same means. Totalitarian, absolute government control over you, the individual. All these isms simply reflect the mistaken belief that progressively larger governments are needed to address the problems. The two-party system is a distraction. It's a sideshow designed to grab and keep our attention by producing a lot of heated debate, arguments, and political attacks while accomplishing very little. The best analogy is the movie Ocean's 11. Where a group of thieves rob a Las Vegas casino. The getaway van, controlled remotely by the thieves, pulls out of the casino parking lot and is followed by the police to the airport. It's a red herring. The thieves aren't in the van. They're still in the casino, free to walk out the front door with loads of cash while the police are distracted. Our politicians are destroying our economy. They are hijacking private businesses. They are stealing our money and our children's future. Bush did it. Obama is doing it now. But we're fooled because we're distracted by red herrings, such as debate over which party is more irresponsible. They both are. I expect Democrats to attack this message and me, the messenger, because they'll believe that it's pointing fingers at them. I expect Republicans to attack the message and the messenger as well for similar reasons. Both would be 100% accurate. Make no mistake, this is a fight of us versus them. Us comprises those who believe in liberty, as described in the opening lines of the Declaration of Independence. Them comprises those who believe that that definition of liberty must evolve with the times. Politicians, I have a message for you. Americans no longer care about the R or the D after your name. In fact, for a lot of Americans, those letters will probably hurt you. We care about your character. Americans don't want someone whom they always agree with, but someone they can always trust. We want to be a part of a process that is open, transparent, and fair. But most of all, we just want you to do what you promised you would do. We'll call you with our thoughts when we can, but you've got to keep your end of the bargain. Then, and only then, you'll have nothing to worry about. We will be there to watch your back. Let us be the radical thinkers of our day and remember the common sense warnings that George Washington gave us in his farewell speech. The common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of the party are sufficient to make it the interest and duty of a wise people to discourage and restrain it. It serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection. A fire not to be quenched, it demands a uniform vigilance to prevent its bursting into a flame, lest, instead of warming, It should consume. We are now experiencing exactly what George Washington warned us about. Neither party is serious about finding solutions. Their focus is instead on building their own tiny political empires where their guy wins while the country burns. That is not leadership. That is national homicide. They seek to incite political support or raise money by pitting us against each other on issues like abortion or gun control, immigration, and gay marriage, because they know that by igniting heated arguments, the issues are less likely to be solved and their careers are more likely to be secure. Every time you vote against someone rather than for someone, the two-party system wins, and America loses. When we support or vote for candidates outside the two major political parties, we are immediately lectured about wasting our vote or making it easier for the less desirable of the two major candidates to claim victory. These lies are repeated every election, and they must be ignored. You never waste your vote if you vote your conscience. Need proof? Let's look at Arlen Specter. In the 2004 election, two third-party candidates ran, both of whom were considered far more conservative than Specter. But most conservatives figured those minor party candidates would never win, so they sold out their own values and voted for someone who very few people considered to be a true conservative. Now, nearly 5 years later, Specter switched from the Republicans to the Democrats. So I ask you, who wasted their vote? The 4% of people who went with the candidates from the Constitution or Libertarian parties? Or the 53% who voted for a man who later stabbed them in the back by switching parties simply to have the best shot at winning his next election? Common sense tells us that supporting the individual of our choice after having studied his position on the issues is never a waste. Are truth, honesty, and candor any less desirable in candidates that don't happen to be Republicans or Democrats? Stop believing their lies. The enemies are at the gate. They have been there for quite some time. Many liberals have begun to call themselves progressives instead because it sounds new and forward-thinking. But the truth is, it is anything but. It is a movement that requires Americans to sever the ties to our founding and follow an ever-evolving social gospel instead. Common sense tells us that a government that can provide everything is a government capable of taking everything. Wake up. We don't need a new party in power. We need a new way forward. Enough about them. How about us? The American people are... They're like the suckers in a horror movie that always seem to do the stupid thing while the audience is shouting, "Don't open that door! Don't go in there!" But for a short time, we actually listened. We didn't open that door. Instead, we remembered who we really are. September 11th, 2001 changed us as a country. Do you remember the lines filled with Americans who just wanted to donate blood, even though there was none needed? Do you remember the following Sunday's football games were postponed, that the late-night comedians deferred their jokes, and that even trial lawyers respected a self-imposed moratorium on terrorist-related lawsuits? After 9/11, we began to remember our heritage and the power of sacrifice. We returned to our churches, synagogues, and mosques. We reconnected with our neighbors, our friends, our families. 4 months after those attacks, 61% of us believed our country had changed for the better. But short-sighted politicians, professors, businessmen, and other experts who saw America as a giant shopping mall didn't really like the changes. If people were getting to know each other again, they wouldn't be out buying stuff. And if people stopped buying stuff, well, then the whole Ponzi scheme would collapse far sooner than those same experts had expected. The same television executives who filled our sets with acts of violence, murder, and sex took the video of the planes crashing into the towers off the air because they were too offensive or too painful for most people to bear. It was another lie, but it worked. We stopped thinking about 9/11 and how fragile our freedom is, and instead, we followed President Bush's advice to go spend money and get on down to Disney World in Florida. Take your families and enjoy life the way it ought to be enjoyed. The result is that only about 21% of us now believe our country is better off today than it was before September 11th. We've gone back to being September 10th people. Our heads are once again buried in the sand, and our hands are out waiting for the next entitlement paid with free government money. Oh, the free cheese. California is a prime example of that. Their budget went from $75 billion to $145 billion in about 10 years, a 92% increase in state spending. Then, their house of cards came crashing down. California was short $42 billion on their last budget, yet they still won't do the common-sense things that get them back on track, like lifting restrictions on offshore oil drilling. In fact, they're doing the opposite, using the same kind of financial schemes that got them into the mess to get them out of it. Their latest act of genius is to sell bonds to themselves, something that is akin to borrowing money from your wife. If they won't sacrifice for themselves, why should the rest of the country sacrifice for them? We are once again living in the days that will try men's souls. Days that will be remembered by historians as great and perilous. But how will history remember us? Will we be remembered as the heroes of our time? Or as those who lost that which was most precious in order to satiate our own desires and appetites? 5. The cancer of progressivism. Many people will hear the word progressive and immediately think of liberals or Democrats, but they're not synonymous. Progressivism has less to do with the parties and more to do with the individuals who seek to redefine, reshape, and rebuild America into a country where individual liberties and personal property mean nothing if they conflict with the plans and the goals of the state. If the progressive cancer were limited to defined political systems, it would be fairly straightforward to isolate it, treat it, and eventually be free from the disease. But it's not. It has infiltrated both political parties and the entire political class, the bureaucrats, lobbyists, trade unions, and corporations that all look at government as their own personal ATM machine. The progressives weren't interested in taking over the political parties because that kind of thinking was too small. They wanted their movement to engulf the entire country. The progressives on the right believed in statism, an American expansion through military strength, while the progressives on the left believed in statism and expansion through transnationalist entities such as the League of Nations and then later the United Nations. Progressivism is why, with very few exceptions, Americans feel as though the candidates they get to choose from are pretty much the same. Do you elect progressive candidate A or really, really progressive candidate B? One of the hallmarks of progressive thought is the concept of redistribution, the idea that your money and your property are only yours if the state doesn't determine that there is a higher or better use for it. You can see that kind of thinking in the words of one-time Republican President Teddy Roosevelt, who gave a speech titled The New Nationalism, in which he spoke about human welfare. Personal property, Roosevelt said, is, quote, subject to the general right of the community to regulate its use to whatever degree the public welfare may require it, end quote. That was a Republican. His thoughts on accumulated wealth are equally surprising. In the same speech, Roosevelt said, quote, we grudge no man a fortune in civil life if it is honorably obtained and well used. It's not even enough that it should have been gained without doing damage to the community. We should permit it to be gained only so long as the gaining represents benefit to the community. This, I know, implies a policy of far more active governmental interference with social and economic conditions in this country than we have had yet. But I think we've got to face the fact that such an increase in governmental control is now necessary. As a perfect reflection of that attitude, you should remember that Teddy Roosevelt not only endorsed a progressive income tax, but was also the first American president to call for national health insurance. Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, was the next president to further the progressive agenda. Like Roosevelt, Wilson didn't believe there were any restrictions on government's power. Quote, "For it is very clear," he said, "that in fundamental theory, socialism and democracy are almost, if not quite, one and the same. They both rest at the bottom upon the absolute right of the community to determine its own destiny and that of its members. Men as communities are supreme over men as individuals. Democracy is bound by no principle of its own nature to say itself nay as to the exercise of any power. The difference between democracy and socialism is not an essential difference, but only a practical difference, is a difference of organization and policy, not a difference of primary motive." End quote. These two presidents serve as the idols and philosophical foundations for their respective parties, yet both wanted far more government control. Roosevelt, quote, "It has become entirely clear that we must have government supervision of the capitalization, not only of public service corporations, including, particularly, railways, but of all corporations doing an interstate business," end quote. Perhaps that explains why some of these same parties today seem to continually produce the same results, irrespective of what they promise on the campaign trail. Like today, the early 20th century progressives love to rely on experts and use them as an excuse for expanding their power. When progressives brought America the Federal Reserve System, it was so that our banking and financial industries could be regulated by experts. When they brought us increased government interference in the classroom, it was because education experts knew better than parents how best to teach our kids. When they brought us land conservation, it was because experts had figured out that we were abusing the land. When the first waves of the nanny state began to appear, it was because experts had decided that we were drinking too much. Prohibition. Not paying enough taxes. Introduction of the progressive income tax. And spending our money on the wrong things. Redistribution through the tax code. It hasn't ended yet. In 1991, the Progressive Congressional Caucus was formed, and its roster of members now includes over 70 representatives and one senator. Their power and influence is reflected in the fact that half of all House standing committees are chaired by members of this caucus. These politicians may be the most outspoken and radical members of the progressive movement, but they're not alone. There are plenty of others in Congress who share some of the basic ideologies but don't publicly declare themselves progressives. For example, consider former President George W. Bush's defense of the massive wealth redistribution that took place through his Medicare prescription drug benefit plan, Part D. Quote, "If you're a low-income senior," he said, "the government is going to pick up a significant portion of your tab. If you're an average-income senior, you're going to see your drug bills cut in half." Of course, when Bush said that the government would be picking up the tab, he really meant that the tab would be paid for by American taxpayers and their children and grandchildren. When Hillary Clinton was asked if she was a liberal during the nationally televised presidential debates, she responded that she preferred, quote, "the word progressive, which has a real American meaning, going back to the progressive era at the beginning of the 20th century," end quote. She went on to say, quote, I consider myself a modern progressive, someone who believes strongly in individual rights and freedoms, who believes that we are better as a society when we're working together, end quote. That should have been a marching order to Americans to go back and read the history of the early 20th century progressive movement. Even John McCain, the conservative candidate, once said that Theodore Roosevelt was one of his favorite presidents. And you still wonder why it feels like elections offer us no real choice. These candidates may come from different political parties, but their philosophy of the government's role all came from the same corrupt well. The presidential election of 2008 was truly a repeat of the presidential election of 1912, in which America was really only offered a progressive Republican and a progressive Democrat as candidates. Parallels between the words and actions of our current president and those of our progressive forefathers aren't hard to find either. Woodrow Wilson once said, quote, We must demand that the individual shall be willing to lose the sense of personal achievement and shall be content to realize his activity only in connection to the activity of the many. Wow, that's spooky. And sounds eerily like President Obama's campaign answer to Joe the Plumber, who is worried that his taxes would rise. Quote, It's not that I want to punish your success, Obama told him. I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance to success too. I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody. End quote. As I said before, progressives didn't simply want to create a new party. They wanted to usher in a new form of government. After all, elected representatives were fallible because they were selected by ordinary people instead of those trusted experts. But those aren't just words. They were a call to action. The progressive era was an immediate manifestation of that call, but it was far from the end of it. Over the last century, progressives have successfully moved our country towards more government control and less personal freedom, and they are still pushing the envelope. I want to be clear here. Progressives are not doing this as some sort of a master plan to take down America. In fact, it's just the opposite. They love their country and genuinely believe that this is the best way forward. The problem is that there are fewer and fewer people able to stand in their way because we don't teach real American history anymore, let alone the real history and vision of the progressive movement. The principles of freedom and liberty and the beliefs of our founding fathers have basically been whitewashed from the curriculum, leading to generations of Americans who have no idea what people like Wilson or Teddy Roosevelt really stood for. The progressives view the Constitution as a living organism that evolves with time and changes depending on circumstances. Both the progressives and the founding fathers view the Constitution as a set of handcuffs. But the difference is that our founders believed that it was the power of the state that was to be cuffed, while progressives believed it was individuals who were cuffed to the greater good of the group. One of those two positions will eventually win out, and that will dictate how future generations will live their lives. The battle between these two philosophies is taking place right now in all areas of our lives, but there are a few key issues that progressives are using to drive their agenda forward: the environment, gun control, education, and religion. As we go through each of them, consider how our leaders have bypassed the idea of massive overnight change in favor of reshaping our opinions slowly over time, a concept that James Madison warned us about well before progressivism had even been given a name. Quote, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpation. The right kind of green. Despite what Al Gore probably thinks, he didn't create the green movement. Back in the early 1900s, there were several types of electric cars competing with Henry Ford's gasoline-powered Model Ts, and car companies have been seriously experimenting with hydrogen-based fuels since the 1970s. But while Gore didn't invent the idea of environmental responsibility, he did, along with politicians like George W. Bush, John McCain, and members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, figure out a way to use it to further his progressive agenda. At first glance, climate change and going green don't seem like issues that relate to the battle playing out for our country's soul. But that's because we often look at them in a vacuum. If you back away and see the forest instead of the individual trees, you quickly realize what's really going on. Leaders who want more government control over our business, economy, and personal lives can't simply snap their fingers and get it. They need a vehicle to take them there. My contention is that climate change is that vehicle. Not surprisingly, the conservation movement came into its own during the Progressive period. The Sierra Club was founded in 1892, and just 20 years later, Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed, "There can be no greater issue than that of conservation in this country." Today we have Al Gore preaching the same gospel to a different audience. But instead of trying to convince adults who may be set in their ways, he smartly appeals to the feelings and instincts of minors. During an inauguration celebration for President Obama, Gore spoke to a group of 13 to 17-year-old honor students. He explained to them that current-day anti-global warming sentiments are a lot like racist sentiments were decades ago. He told them, quote, "Look, there's a lot of things you understand instinctively, but your parents don't understand those things because they're just too trapped in old thinking," end quote. Do these men truly believe in what they're saying? Do they honestly believe that the environment can really be saved through government intervention, or is the environment just a vehicle towards the progressive ideal of total government rule? Like Gore, Roosevelt didn't just use words. He demanded action. He limited personal freedom and ignored states' rights by giving government more power over water and grazing rights, creating over 50 bird preserves through executive order, and with a stroke of a pen, establishing more than 20 national forests. It didn't matter to him that businesses, individuals, and states were negatively impacted by each of these decisions, or that their rights to those previously public areas were taken away. Roosevelt argued that, as he put it, quote, "the greatest good for the greatest number," end quote, required such action. The new nationalism, he said, quote, "puts the national need before sectional or personal advantage," end quote. We hear the same arguments today. Politicians lecture us that jobs must be sacrificed and factories closed for the sake of the greater good. We're told that we can't drill for oil, develop nuclear power, or burn clean coal because of the environmental impacts. We're told by our president, quote, "we can't drive our SUVs and eat as much as we want and keep our homes on 72 degrees at all times," end quote. Words that eerily echo Teddy Roosevelt's calls for a new spirit of service and a new spirit of sacrifice. Quoting, "where each of us resolves to pitch in and work harder and look after not only ourselves, but each other," end quote. In the 1970s, progressives used global cooling as their call to action. That call included, naturally, increased government control. In the 1980s, as science refuted claims of global cooling, progressives argued for more government power and control to fight global warming instead. Today, desperate to explain long periods of cooler temperatures, increased ice formations at the southern polar cap, and other inconvenient global warming truths, progressives now tell us that government must have the power, resources, and money to fight climate change, whichever direction that change might be. We are told that humans are destroying the planet, and that only scientists the experts, or the very rich, the very famous, or very powerful can save it. I guess maybe those people are so busy flying on their private jets, attending international climate conferences, and accusing us of poisoning the planet that they either don't notice their hypocrisy, or they accept it as the price for the great work that they're supposedly doing. We don't trust the political class because they no longer find shame in their own hypocrisy. As always, the hypocrisy is loudest in Washington. In 2007, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced with great fanfare that Congress, quote, was going green, end quote, by replacing 12,000 incandescent light bulbs with environmentally friendly compact fluorescent ones. Trees would also be planted and carbon offsets purchased. What you didn't see in her press conference was the carbon-belching Capital Power Plant that burns more than 17,000 tons of coal each year. The plant's proud owner? None other than the United States Congress. Since Congress owns the power plant and Speaker Pelosi controls the House, isn't she ultimately responsible for the multiple Clean Air Act violations that the plant has been cited for? Congress apparently felt it could operate the power plant guilt-free because it purchased close to $90,000 worth of carbon credits. Those credits allow an entity to emit carbon in exchange for paying another entity to offset that carbon by planting trees or sequestering CO2, thereby eliminating or reducing the same amount of carbon. This year, Nancy Pelosi's much-heralded plans for carbon-neutral, guilt-free Congress died an unceremonious death. Congress will no longer purchase carbon credits. No reason was given for the change, but perhaps Congress was embarrassed by the revelation that several of the companies hired to offset their gluttony had already reduced their carbon outputs long before they were contracted by Congress to do so. In other words, if you give somebody $1,000 to plant 10 trees, but later found out that they planted those trees 5 years ago, have you really done anything to help the environment, or are you just helping your own conscience? In the case of Congress, it was definitely the latter. Common sense tells us that the simpletons running our government should have learned from their own failed 2-year experiment with carbon credits that the system doesn't work. But instead, they've come to a different conclusion. They've decided that while they will no longer purchase carbon credits, American businesses and corporations must start to. In the same month that they abandoned carbon credits, Congress introduced a 648-page bill that could effectively impose the carbon credit scheme on every American business. Yet, in all of those pages, two simple questions are not answered. Who will be taxed? And how will the money that is raised in what one politician called the most significant revenue-generating proposal of our time be spent? What was included in the bill were explicit details of every new efficiency standard, such as protocols for putting on a slanted roof that could require fiberglass asphalt shingle roofing. There were also 10 pages discussing portable lighting, including a section on artwork lighting fixtures, and another section spelling out the details of standby power needs for hot tubs. The hubris, arrogance, and hypocrisy of politicians has no limits. They seek to impose laws on us that they themselves cannot tolerate. It's a return to the do-as-I-say and not-as-I-do mentality, and it is taking us down a subtle road to tyranny. The light bulb lie. Warning, this product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer. Warning, this product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause birth defects or other reproductive harm. Wow, sounds like a nasty, dangerous product, right? It is. The product is mercury, and it can be toxic, which is why California wanted those two warnings posted on cans of tuna. But if mercury is so very dangerous, then why would Congress require that mercury-filled light bulbs be used in our homes, offices, hospitals, and churches starting in 2012? Compact fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs, contain an average of 4 milligrams of mercury each, far more than the 0.12 milligrams contained in a can of light tuna. It gets worse. The light bulbs these self-serving politicians decreed must be used in your home in order to save the environment are so poisonous that the Environmental Protection Agency actually created cleanup procedures to be followed whenever a CFL is broken. Here are just a few of the highlights. Before cleanup, air out the room. Have people and pets leave the room, and don't let anyone walk through the breakage area on their way out. Open a window and leave the room for 15 minutes or more. Shut off the central forced air heating air conditioning system if you have one. Cleanup steps for carpeting or rug. Carefully pick up glass fragments and place them in a glass jar with a metal lid, such as a canning jar, or in a sealed plastic bag. Use sticky tape, such as duct tape, to pick up any remaining small glass fragments and powder. If vacuuming is needed, after all visible materials are removed, vacuum the area where the light bulb was broken. Remove the vacuum bag, or empty and wipe the canister, and put the bag or the vacuum debris in a sealed plastic bag. Clean up steps for clothing, bedding, and other soft materials. If clothing or bedding materials come in direct contact with broken glass or mercury-containing powder from inside the bulb that may stick to the fabric, the clothing or bedding should be thrown away. Do not wash such clothing or bedding because mercury fragments in the clothing may contaminate the machine and/or pollute sewage. Disposal of cleanup materials. Immediately place all cleanup materials outdoors in a trash container or protected area for next normal trash pickup. Check with your local or state government about disposal requirements in your specific area. Some states do not allow such trash disposal. Instead, they require that broken and unbroken mercury-containing bulbs be taken to a local recycling center. One woman who had the misfortune of breaking a compact fluorescent light bulb in her home was told by her State Department of Environmental Protection that the spilled mercury levels were 6 times higher than the state's safe level, and therefore a cleanup performed by a professional hazardous material team should be considered at a cost of several thousand dollars. Well, at least we know how many agencies it will take to change a CFL. 2. The local Department of Environmental Protection and the local Hazardous Material Disposal Unit. If you bury your head in the sand and believe that things will just get better on their own, that one day you'll wake up and government will have decided to simply leave you alone, then you deserve to see your children wearing the chains of government servitude. Each and every feel-good environmental policy has a price attached to it. Politicians and extremist environmentalists never talk about the cost of carbon credits or CFLs or cap-and-trade programs, but not talking about it doesn't make the cost any less real. For example, in his latest book, Professor Thomas Sowell talks about how homes were far more expensive in cities and towns that adopted environmental smart growth and open space policies. Why? Supply and demand. By imposing an artificial restriction on developable land, the cost of buildable land rose. It's another example of the difference between feeling and thinking. Open space feels good. But once you think about it, you realize there's a substantial hidden cost. Climate change has all the components needed to be an issue used to reshape America. Massive support from the younger generation, a feel-good quality to it that people feel guilty for opposing, ties to the most important, most influential global corporations and leaders, ties to the world's energy supply, and most importantly, trillions of dollars at stake. How many people did Michael Moore speak for when he said that Obama has, quote, the massive will of the American people behind him, and had been granted, still quoting, permission by us to do what he sees fit, end quote. That is simply not the way our republic works. A person who does what he sees fit is not a president. He's a dictator. We cannot allow the Michael Moores of the world to speak for us. Isn't it amazing that the law does not require one human being to save another human being from injury or death? If you see a stranger, or even a relative, drowning in a pool, the law doesn't impose any obligation on you to save them, even if you could do so without risk to yourself. Yet the same legal system requires you, under threat of penalty, to recycle, to avoid letting your car idle, and to put CFL bulbs with poisonous mercury into your homes, all to save the environment. Common sense tells us that any legal system based on such grotesquely misplaced priorities is one that cannot endure for long. The endless laws, rules, and regulations, 51,000 new ones have been added since 1995, already on the books, along with the ones that are still coming, like cap and trade, are not really about breaking your bad habits, but about breaking your spirit. They're about sending you the message that you are no more important or significant than the spotted owl or salt marsh harvest mouse. These laws are a stark reminder that your significance as an individual, even as a human being, depends on the recognition you are granted by the state. We are all being trained that we are simply a small part of a much larger community made up of humankind, along with trees, plants, and animals, and that we are all equal. But to do that, progressives have to make you forget that your rights were endowed to you directly by your creator, something they can best make happen by turning us all into what progressive H.G. Wells called, quote, enlightened Nazis, end quote. People who look to the state for direction in every aspect of our lives, but without the violence that accompanied the Nazi movement. But there is good news. Those who are using the environment as a red herring are easy to identify. As I said earlier, people who know they're right about an issue will never back away from a debate. But that's exactly what supporters of new global warming taxes and schemes do. Sure, they write books or produce documentaries, but for an issue that could literally redefine the country, if not the world, don't we demand more than just hearing the experts all agree? After all, the experts all once agreed that America would never be threatened by another depression. The government agrees. You are the problem. Gun sales are spiking. Stores are running out of ammunition. Why? Because people don't trust their government. And the feeling seems to be mutual. Your government doesn't trust you either, at least not with owning a gun. It's not that the government is anti-gun. It's not. It purchases more guns and arms more people than any other group in America. 30 federal agencies and more than 85,000 government employees or contractors carry weapons. In comparison, the entire Canadian active duty army has fewer people carrying arms than our federal government's civilian agencies. So the government isn't anti-gun, but by their constant introduction of new regulations and arduous requirements, they seem to be anti-you owning a gun. The way the flawed logic in Washington apparently works is that if you're protecting federal property or providing security to government employees, our government wants to make sure that you have access to a gun. But if you want that same gun to protect your family and home, oh, our government treats you like a common criminal. I urge you to remember that the power of government is limited to the power that we have lent it. It cannot have any power that we as citizens do not have. If the government claims for itself the right to defend its property and people through the use of arms, then common sense tells us that we must also have that same right. Rights come from God to us, and we lend them to government. We must never allow them to convince us that our rights come from them. We are endowed with a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Again, common sense tells us that if we are so endowed, we must also have the means to protect those rights. Patrick Henry summed it up like this. Are we at last brought to such humiliating and debasing degradation that we cannot be trusted with arms for our defense? Where is the difference between having our arms in possession and under our direction and having them under the management of Congress? If our defense be the real object of having those arms, in whose hands can they be trusted with more propriety or equal safety to us as in our own hands? There are many in Washington and in academic circles who want to leave you defenseless. They seek to compel you to rely on a government for your own protection. They believe that our best defense against gun violence is to hope that the shooter will eventually run out of bullets. That sentiment is easily shared by those who have armed guards, send their children to private schools, and can afford to live in gated communities. Our Second Amendment rights will continue to be under constant yet subtle assault. After all, politicians know better than to target the Second Amendment directly. Founder George Mason identified this early on. When the resolution of enslaving America was formed in Great Britain, the British Parliament was advised by an artful man, who was the governor of Pennsylvania, to disarm the people, that it was the best and most effectual way to enslave them, but they should not do it openly, but weaken them and let them sink gradually. And that is exactly what is happening now. Consider what politicians have done or are doing in making getting, keeping, or learning about guns more difficult. In Washington, D.C., government officials will let you register handguns that are olive, drab green, dark earth, or black, but not two-tone black, because that color doesn't appear on the safe handgun roster. The city of Chicago requires you to re-register your gun every year, and if you do not comply, the gun is considered unregisterable, meaning that it can no longer be kept within the city limits. In New York City, obtaining a gun permit can take nearly a year and cost more than $500. Mountains of notarized paperwork must be meticulously filled out, including character references and driving records, and the applicant must undergo a personal interview with a police investigator. There are those that will naively insist that these smaller steps are necessary to promote the greater good, or that our government, although not perfect, would never intentionally hurt or imprison any of its own innocent citizens. They will concede that while such actions may have taken place after guns were taken away in Germany and the Soviet Union, such things could never happen here. When they say this, please remind them of three things. 1. Remind them of the victims of Presidential Executive Order 9066, which authorized the forcible relocation of 150,000 Japanese Americans from their homes to internment camps. This order, signed by President Franklin Roosevelt, a progressive, accepted the progressive argument that the greater good required the wholesale incarceration of Americans despite their constitutional rights to due process and private property. Many of these Japanese Americans never got their homes back or property returned. The only mistake these Japanese Americans made was that they believed in the rule of law and in the rights guaranteed by our Constitution. We take most of that for granted these days. But this black mark on our history proves that the state believes that our most basic rights can be suspended whenever it sees fit. We see this same progressive mindset today playing out in two key areas, eminent domain and privacy rights. Eminent domain. nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Fifth Amendment, U.S. Constitution. Eminent domain is the power of the state to take private property for what is essentially the progressive idea of benefiting the greater good. Historically, government was severely restricted in its ability to take your home or land. They had to have public use for doing so, such as building a new highway. The word use is very important and was specifically included in the Constitution's Fifth Amendment by James Madison, who also included that compensation must be provided for any property taken. Why the word use? Well, it was a compromise. Our Constitution was shaped greatly by the founders' experience with the tyrannical British government, which took private property virtually at will. Madison wanted language that he hoped would prevent our government from eventually falling into that same trap, but he had to compromise. Since some founders felt that public purpose, a term that would give the government far more power, was more appropriate. In retrospect, arguments over purpose versus use seem irrelevant, because the Supreme Court now has weighed in. In Kelo versus City of New London, they sanctioned the taking of private property even in cases where there was no direct public use. In the Kelo case, it meant allowing the city to seize private property and sell it to a developer solely for the public benefit of increasing the municipal tax rolls. But benefit does not equal use. A lot of things might benefit the greater good, such as seizing a part of town with the ugliest houses, demolishing them, and selling the land to a developer. But they're not of public use, so they're unconstitutional. Or at least they used to be. Private property is essential to personal freedom and liberty because it enables an individual to gain independence from the state by accumulating land, money, and wealth. In the Declaration of Independence, the Founding Fathers wanted to assert that Americans were protected in their life, liberty, and property, but were instead persuaded to write life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Why? Because they didn't want the Southern slave states to be able to continue their practice by asserting that slaves were property and therefore a protected right. The importance that private property plays in preserving freedom can easily be seen in the words of those who had diametrically opposed beliefs in the role of government. John Adams, quote, "The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence." Karl Marx, "The theory of communist may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property," end quote. Privacy rights. It's not just our homes that are no longer secure from the whims of the state. It's also our own bodies. Almost all states now require mandatory blood screening tests with limited opt-out provisions. The experts tell us that the testing is necessary for a host of profound medical reasons, such as protecting children. But that slippery slope is already rearing its head as efforts are now being made to empower the state to retain, test, and research the blood and DNA of newborn babies. I understand this can sound conspiratorial, but I don't apologize for not trusting the government to exercise caution and sound judgment. Neither would our founders. Even if their intentions are good now, who is to say what they will be in 10, 20, or 100 years? What limits can there possibly be on state power if it's allowed to extract a blood sample from every newborn baby without the consent of the parents? Just as the backward idea that helping others in danger is not mandated by law, but recycling is, I believe another sign of a society in decline is when those accused of murder and rape have their blood and DNA protected more than innocent newborn babies. 2. Remind your friends about the tens and thousands of political, labor, and anti-war activists who were arrested for speaking out against their government and its policies, beginning with Woodrow Wilson and continuing through FDR's presidency. Once again, the constitutional protections of free speech and the right to assembly meant nothing to the progressives, who successfully argued that the greater good and national security of government were best served by arresting Americans who exercised those rights. We see the same mindset today, albeit on a different level. The Department of Homeland Security recently issued a report titled Right-Wing Extremism, Current Economic and Political Climate Fueling Resurgence in Radicalization and Recruitment. It essentially concludes that those who are passionate about the sanctity of life, believe in the Second Amendment right to bear arms, or are veterans of the armed forces, pose a heightened security risk to the country and may require heightened monitoring. True, no one has started rounding up these extremists yet. But how long do you think it'll be before that national security of the government argument is resurrected again? There is a sad irony between the rights our leaders fight for and the ones that really matter. Remember all of those politicians who strongly objected to the wiretapping of calls between the United States and someone overseas when at least one party was suspected of terrorism? They couldn't believe that a government would egregiously violate the rights of Americans like that. Yet when the Department of Homeland Security says to keep an eye on tens of millions of Americans who have done nothing except to obey the law and exercise their constitutional rights, these hypocrites say absolutely nothing. They are truly cockroaches who care nothing about liberty and freedom. 3. Remind your friends about the law-abiding citizens of New Orleans, who, while trying to protect their families and property in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, had their guns unlawfully confiscated under orders from the mayor and chief of police. This is a modern-day example of progressive thought in action. Americans who legally purchased and legally owned their guns had them taken away by politicians who dismissed the Constitution and the law because it was necessary for the greater good and safety of the public. And, add insult to injury, the city of New Orleans won't try to find the rightful owners of the guns they confiscated. If they stole your gun, you actually have to apply to have it returned. And what did our elected leaders, the people who took an oath to uphold the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, do after the guns of law-abiding Americans were unlawfully confiscated? They passed a law. Yeah, they made it illegal to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. Isn't that already one of the protections of the Second Amendment? If the